All right, let's turn to Numbers chapter 28. In this session, we'll cover chapters 28, 29, and 30, all of which are, we could say, not the most invigorating material in Numbers, because there are no stories in these chapters, only laws and judgments that are made. But important ones to the Jews who lived under the sacrificial system. Chapters 28 and 29 are broken into two chapters because it'd be too long to make into a single chapter, apparently, someone judged. And so they broke it down. But actually, chapters 28 and 29 are pretty much one continuous treatment of what offerings will be offered on the special days and what the grain offerings will be that are associated with them. Now, we've noticed in the past that God's sacred calendar included weekly holy days, the Sabbath, and monthly ones, the new moons, as well as annual ones. There's actually, in a sense, every day was a holy day, and therefore we're going to see that we're going to cover what was the content or the substance of the burnt offerings that were to be offered every morning and every evening. And these were supposed to be the same 6 days a week. But on the Sabbath, each Sabbath, these sacrifices would be doubled. So the Jews had what they called the continual burnt offering, which was a lamb in the morning and a lamb in the evening every weekday. And two lambs in the morning, two lambs in the evening every Sabbath. Now, this was not something the children of Israel themselves brought, like every child of Israel brought a lamb every day. But rather, the priests would offer one lamb a day for the whole nation in the morning, and one lamb a day in the evening for the whole nation, and likewise twice that on Sabbath. And in the first 10 verses, we're going to see that. The first 8 verses talk about the regular weekdays and the daily offerings that would be offered. Then verses 9 and 10 tell us that the Sabbath, that it will be doubled on the Sabbath. And then in the remainder of chapter 28 and chapter 29, it goes to those sacrifices that would be less frequent than daily and even less frequent than weekly. Because in verses 11 through 25, or excuse me, 11 through 15, it talks about the new moons. It doesn't use the word new moons in these verses, although the term is used in chapter 29, verse 6 for these. The new moon was the beginning of the month. They had a lunar calendar they were going by, and therefore, at the same point on the lunar cycle, they'd begin each month. And so the first day of the month was called the new moon. It is in verse 6 of chapter 29 that we see them called that, besides the burnt offering with its grain offering for the new moons. But in verse 11, it just says at the beginning of your months, which was the same thing. So verses 11 through 15 talk about the monthly celebration of the new moon and the sacrifices that we offered on that festival. And then there were the annual festivals. Passover is discussed, and unleavened bread in verses 16 through 25. Then the Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, as it's called, in verses 26 through 31. And then as you go into the next chapter, chapter 29, verses 1 through 6, going to discuss the sacrifices offered on the Feast of Trumpets, which was Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the civil new year. And then it skips to the Day of Atonement, which was 15 days later, in verses 7, chapter 29, verses 7 through 11. That's the offerings to be offered on the Day of Atonement. And then almost the rest of the chapter, chapter 29, verses 12 through 38, discuss the offerings to be offered at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the reason such a large space is given to that is because at the Feast of Tabernacles, each day of that week of the celebration, they offered a different number of bulls, actually a diminishing number, from 13 on the first day to 7. On the seventh day, they would reduce the number by 1 each day. And that's the only one of the feasts that they did that. All the other feasts, they offered the same exact same thing every day of the week for Passover and for Pentecost. And so what we're going to find in these chapters covering that particular information is that he's going to tell us what burnt offerings they were supposed to offer on these occasions, and when it applies, what sin offering they're going to offer, and what the grain offerings would be associated with them. Now, as far as the grain offerings, these are redundant very much. It's always the same grain offering for a bull, and no matter what day it is. It's always the same grain offering for a lamb. It's always the same grain offering for a goat. Those grain offerings were laid out for us in chapter 15. Back when it was just saying what the grain offerings would be for particular sacrifices. That is, when they offered a burnt offering of a bull, there was a certain prescribed amount of grain that would be actually flour mixed with oil, and also a drink offering of wine that would be offered with every bull. And if it was a ram, it'd be a different amount of grain and wine and oil. If it was a lamb, it'd be, or a goat, it'd be a lesser amount still. So back in chapter 15 of Numbers, we saw that when it is a lamb that is offered, they offer 1/10 of an ephah of flour, 1/4 of a hin each of oil and wine. And if it's a ram, we saw in Numbers 15, verses 6 through 7, that the numbers are increased. Instead of 1/10 ephah of flour, it's 2/10 ephah of flour. It's a larger animal. Instead of 1/4 of a hin of oil and wine, it's 1/3 of a hin of oil and wine. And in chapter 15, verses 8 through 10, it mentions if it's a bull, the amount of flour is raised again, this time to 3/10 of an ephah. And the amount of oil and wine is increased from 1/3 to 1/2 a hin. Now, we don't know ephahs and hins anyway. But we can see the general pattern here is that for a larger animal, it's a larger amount of flour and oil and wine offered. And the exact amounts for each animal are prescribed in chapter 15 and followed to the letter in verses 28 and 29. But that, of course, makes the narrative bulky, because every time it tells about one of these days and what is offered, it also gives the details about how much flour, how much oil, how much wine is offered as well. Something that hardly would seem to be necessary to repeat as many times. Certainly not for our benefit. For the priests, maybe. And remember, we see that the Jewish priesthood seemed to have a great love for repetition and for detail and so forth. One that is not as well appreciated by the likes of us, who would like to read through something and get the information and not have to just wade through the same verbiage 12 times or whatever, you know, which is bulky. However, we will read some of this and summarize some of it. In chapter 28, verse 1, "Now Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel and say to them, My offering, my food for my offerings, made by fire as a sweet aroma to me, you shall be careful to offer to me at their appointed time. And you shall say to them, This is the offering made by fire which you shall offer to the Lord, 2 male lambs in their day of the first year without blemish, day by day, as a regular burnt offering. The one lamb you shall offer in the morning, the other lamb you shall offer in the evening. And 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering, mixed with 1/4 of a hin of pressed oil. It is a regular burnt offering, which is ordained at Mount Sinai for a sweet aroma, an offering made by fire to the Lord." Now, back when they were at Mount Sinai, God said they'd offer this regular daily offering of a lamb every day. It did not there mention that that would be doubled on the Sabbath. But it does. We do get that when we get to verses 9 and 10 here. It says in verse 7, "And its drink offering shall be 1/4 of a hin of for each lamb," that'd be a hin of wine, "in a holy place you shall pour out the drink to the Lord as an offering. The other lamb you shall offer in the evening as the morning grain offering, and its drink offering you shall offer as an offering made by fire, sweet aroma to the Lord. So basically same thing morning as in the evening. A lamb each time, you know, a fourth of a hin of flour. Excuse me, a tenth of an ephah of flour, a fourth of a hin of oil and wine in each case. Then verses 9 and 10, and on the Sabbath day, two lambs in their first year without blemish, and two-tenths of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering mixed with oil with its drink offering. This is a burnt offering for every Sabbath besides the regular burnt offerings with its drink offering. Then we have the monthly offerings. These are not mentioned very often in the Old Testament. In fact, I was once talking to a Seventh-day Adventist about Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16. And, of course, that's the passage that says, where Paul says, let no man judge you concerning what you eat or drink. And he goes on to say, nor concerning, he says, a festival or new moons or Sabbaths. This is Colossians 2:16. Therefore, let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or new moon or Sabbaths. And this particular individual is trying to tell me that these are not talking about Jewish ordinances. It's talking about pagan ordinances, pagan festivals, pagan new moons, pagan Sabbaths, which I disagreed with. But he was saying, where, after all, in the Old Testament does it ever say to celebrate the new moons? And it was his opinion that new moons were not part of the Jewish celebration, and therefore Paul was not talking about Jewish festivals and new moons and Sabbaths, but about pagan ones. But actually, he was mistaken. Actually, there is a command to observe the new moons in the law. It's not very often mentioned, but it is mentioned here in Numbers 28:11. At the beginnings of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord, two young bulls, one ram, and seven lambs in the first year without blemish. And then, of course, it talks about how much grain offering for each of those animals. And it's the same as the grain offerings for each of those kinds of animals that is given in Numbers 15. In addition to those burnt offerings, which was two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs of a year old, they were also at the new moon supposed to offer a sin offering, one goat kid, mentioned in verse 15. So they would offer a total of 10 animals as burnt offerings on the first day of the month, and one animal, a goat kid, as a sin offering. And the, you know, grain offerings apply as previously. So daily they're offering one lamb as a burnt offering in the morning, one at night. Sabbaths, it's two lambs in the morning, two lambs at night. And once on the first day of the month, it's a much larger festival, actually. Two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs offered, plus a goat kid. Now, we come then to the annual festivals. Passover is the first one to be considered. On the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. And on the 15th day of the month is the feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. And you shall present an offering made by fire as a burnt offering to the Lord. And so they were to do, actually, every day of the seven to offer the same offerings. What are they? Well, it's the same burnt offerings as they offered on the new moons. It'd be two young bulls, one ram, seven lambs for the first year. So, and the proper grain offerings associated with them. So really, the offerings, each of the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread were to be exactly the same offerings they'd offer on a new moon. Two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs as burnt offerings. Although, yes, and the goat of the sin offering also, verse 22. So it's exactly the same as on a new moon. And so it is also every day of the Feast of Weeks in verses 26 through 31. It says, also on the day of the first fruits, when you bring a new grain offering to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation and you shall do no customary work. You shall present a burnt offering as a sweet aroma to the Lord, two young bulls, one ram, seven lambs the first year, of course. And here I don't believe it mentions the sin offering. It may be implied, or it may be that it was not the case that they offered a sin offering on Pentecost, or I'm not sure. I don't see the sin offering in this list. So that's an exception. But it may be that it was implied that the sin offering is supposed to be there too. After all, it's just like the others in other respects. Oh, I take that back. There is one kid of the goats in verse 30. It doesn't say a sin offering, but it says to make an atonement for you. So there is a sin offering there in verse 30. So it is just the same. Whether it's the 7 days of unleavened bread or the 7 days of the Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, they offer exactly the same sacrifices every single day that they offered on every new moon. So there's a lot of repetition here of the same ceremony once a month plus all these different days on an annual basis. Now, I will point out in verse 26 the reference to the day of the first fruits associated with the Feast of Weeks. When we went through the Jewish calendar year in Leviticus chapter 23, we saw that there was a day of the first fruits where they waved the barley sheaves before the Lord. That was just on the first Sunday after the Passover. And then the Feast of Weeks was like many weeks later, 50 days later, 7 weeks afterwards. So what they called the first fruits was really more closely associated with Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread than with weeks. However, here it is associated with the Feast of Weeks, and therefore it must not be referring to that day, but rather apparently the first day of the Pentecost. And that is because, of course, Pentecost was also a harvest festival, all the festivals were related to harvest. At Passover, they offered the first fruits of the barley harvest. 7 weeks later, they were ready to offer the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and that would be the first fruits mentioned here, apparently. Now, chapter 29, the Feast of Trumpets, again, is just a day. It's just a single day, the first day of the seventh month, Rosh Hashanah. And guess what? They offer exactly the same offerings as they do every new moon. So they offer the two bulls, one ram, seven lambs, and one goat as a sin offering, and all the appropriate grain offerings as well. Not much more to observe about that. In fact, it specifically says it's the same as the new moons in verse 6, besides the burnt offering with its grain offering for the new moon, the regular burnt offering with its grain offering, and their drink offerings according to their ordinance. You know, it may be that what this means is that if if Rosh Hashanah happens to fall on a new moon, on the first day of the month, well, it is. It is the first day of the month. So it is a new moon, come to think of it. And therefore, it says you must offer double that. You offer the two bulls, one ram and seven lambs for Rosh Hashanah, and then you offer another two bulls, one ram and seven lambs for the new moon, apparently. So you double it because Rosh Hashanah is a new moon. It's the first day of the month, the seventh month. Now, the Day of Atonement, of course, is the tenth day of the seventh month, 9 days after Rosh Hashanah. I think I gave the wrong information a moment ago when I mentioned this. The tenth day of the seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall afflict your souls. You shall not do any work. You shall present a burnt offering to the Lord as a sweet aroma. One young bull, one ram, and seven lambs in their first year. Be sure they are without blemish. And their grain offerings. Also, down in verse 11, one kid of the goats. Now, for sin offering. Now, here it seems different because they offer one bull instead of two on the Day of Atonement. And that may be because this is in addition to all the other offerings they do in the course of the Day of Atonement. Remember, the Day of Atonement is a day of several different offerings anyway, and it may be that these are additional. And instead of two bulls, as they would normally do on other sacred days, they have only one bull they offer here. All right, so then we come to the offerings for the Feast of Tabernacles. And this is on the 15th day of the seventh month. And the main difference here from all the other 7-day-long festivals is that there's a change every day in the number of bulls that are offered. There is the a consistent and uniform number of rams and lambs and goats that are offered each day, but the number of bulls changes. And, you know, why this is a matter of curiosity, of course. I don't know of any commentator that has been able to offer an answer for that, why the Feast of Tabernacles would have this change and the other feasts do not. On the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, we find that they present as a burnt offering, verse 13 says, they offer 13 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year, and then they're going to offer, in verse 16, 1 kid of the goats as a sin offering. So it looks a little like the other days, except the numbers are different. The kid for the sin offering is the same as all these other days, but different number of bulls, rams, and lambs. We got 13 bulls, 2 rams, and 14 lambs. And as I say, the number of rams, lambs, and the kid remain the same for the 7 days of the festival, but the number of bulls changes. Verse 17, on the second day, present 12 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs, and the rest. Verse 19, a kid of the goats. Verse 20, on the third day, present 11 bulls. Verse 23, on the fourth day, present 10 bulls. Verse 26, on the fifth day, present 9 bulls. Verse 29, on the sixth day, present 8 bulls. And verse 32, on the seventh day, present 7 bulls. Obviously, we're counting down to 7, the perfect number. But why it's counting down at all is not at all clear. And commentators don't seem to know. So if you get the revelation about that, and you figure that out, you may be able to write a doctoral thesis and get a doctorate, because it's something that has not been done. And it's something that remains to be discovered. But this mentions the eighth day, which is, of course, the day at the end of this whole series in verse 35. On the eighth day, you shall have a sacred assembly. You shall do no customary work. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering made by fire as a sweet aroma to the Lord, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 lambs in their first year without blemish, and their grain offerings, which is, of course, what they would offer at a new moon, which is what they offer almost every sacred day, apart from their daily and Sabbath burnt offerings. Every time there's a sacred occasion, whether it's the new moon, whether it's one of the days of unleavened bread, or one of the days of Pentecost, or whether it's the Feast of Trumpets, these same offerings are offered, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 lambs. Excuse me, I'm wrong. Usually it's 2 bulls. It was, in fact, 1 bull for the Day of Atonement, but the other times it's 2 bulls. So I'm getting confused here. It's hard to keep the numbers straight. Now, verse 39, these things you shall present to the Lord at your appointed feast, besides your vowed offerings and your free will offerings, as your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, as your drink offerings and your peace offerings. So Moses told the children of Israel everything just as Yahweh commanded Moses. Now, verse 39 is saying that these are constants. These sacrifices have to be made on these holy days no matter what. Now, there's, of course, additional things that people can bring voluntarily besides. And they have their vows and their free will offerings. Now, the free will offerings included burnt offerings and peace offerings and grain offerings. As we saw in the opening chapters of Leviticus, which listed these offerings and gave regulations, the burnt offerings, most of them were free will offerings. It's just that there were some that were not free will. They were obligatory. The ones that are listed in chapters 28 and 29 are obligatory burnt offerings. But then in addition to that, people would bring their voluntary offerings. And it mentions, and the things vowed. Having mentioned things vowed, this introduces another issue about women's rights in chapter 30. We saw back in chapter 27 a concern about women's rights of inheritance, and how that if a man had only daughters, that his daughters had the same inheritance rights that sons would have. And now we have the issue of vows. What if a daughter makes a vow, or a wife, and her husband doesn't know about it? Is it binding? Does a woman have the same legal status as a man in these matters? And the answer was not exactly. We'll find that a woman's obligations to keep her vows differ according to a number of things. One would be her marital status, and the other would be whether or not her father or husband, as the case may be, approves of the vow that she makes. And this would be important, of course, because if a woman, let's say a married woman, vowed to give God her son, like Hannah offered to give Samuel to the Lord, if the father didn't have the power to veto that, then his wife could give away all the children against his wishes. And so we find that there is a provision made that when the man of the house hears about a vow made by a woman under his authority, his wife or his daughter, that he has the option to cancel that vow, but only on the day he first hears of it. If he doesn't say anything the day he hears of it, then the vow is binding. Now, there is a separate issue made in verse 9 of a woman who doesn't have a man in her life, a woman who's a widow or a divorced woman. Well, she has the same status as a man in this respect, religiously. Her vows stand just as much as a man's do. And so, and by the way, that's unparalleled in ancient society. The idea that a woman would be under her husband's authority or under her father's authority is fairly commonplace in ancient society, but the idea that a widowed woman or a divorcee has a status very similar to that of a man is unparalleled in the ancient world. So there is, in a sense, an affirmation that women, under proper circumstances, are in exactly the same position as men, with the same responsibilities and rights. But obviously, in a household where there's hierarchy, a woman's vows have got to be subject to the veto of the man of the house, because the affairs of the household are his concern and his responsibility. Now it says, Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord, or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." That's if a man does it. There were earlier provisions made in some of the earlier chapters about how he can redeem the thing he vowed. In other words, if he has regrets about the specific thing he vowed, he can redeem it and add a 20% penalty to himself for redeeming it. The value of it, I think it was the last chapter of Leviticus, if I'm not mistaken, dealt with this issue and how they would redeem things that they had vowed. But unless he redeems the thing, that is, unless he buys it back from the Lord and with a penalty, he has to pay what he vowed. But the case is somewhat more complicated with a woman, as most things are with women. In verse 3, which is not a criticism of women, they're just more complicated. Verse 3, or if a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth. That means when she's still unmarried and she's under her father's authority. And her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she has bound herself, and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. The father has the power to veto, but if he doesn't veto it, her vow is binding, because she is a person of responsibility before God too. It's just that if she has a father who doesn't agree with it, then she's not at liberty to make such vows. It says, but if her father overrules her on the day that he hears, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand. And the Lord will forgive her because her father overruled her. Now, the statement, the Lord will forgive her, is mentioned at the end of all of these provisions. There's three different situations given. One is a daughter in her father's house. The next is a woman who is married, but she made a vow before she was married, so her new husband has the responsibility of either confirming or denying her vow when he hears about it. And the third situation would be a woman who is already married and she makes a vow, and her husband, if he nullifies her vow, then it says in every case the Lord will forgive her in verse 5 and in verse 8 and in verse 12. All those places in these three different circumstances says if the man in her life nullifies her vow on the day he hears of it, he has the right to do that and she will be forgiven for that. Now, does that mean she did something wrong by submitting? No, it just means she'll be released from the vow. She'll be forgiven for the promise. She'll be released from her obligation because she is under the authority of her father in this case. By the way, I know of a case in Idaho of a Christian family, a godly family, whose teenage daughter was very rebellious, and she ran off with a 40-something-year-old man who was a criminal, and he was on the lam, he was running from the law. And they crossed over into Nevada and got married. And she was like 16, and he was in his 40s, and he was a crook, and she was just a rebellious, backslidden girl from a Christian home who had previously professed to be a Christian, and who I believe is now back with the Lord again. But her father, counting on the provisions of this particular chapter, when he heard that she had married the guy, he nullified her vow. Of course, as long as she remained with the man, then she was living in fornication. But she had no right to make a vow. She was still a virgin under her father's authority when she ran off, and therefore her father had the right to cancel her marriage vows. He never approved of them. He actually sent out a letter to other godly men affirming that he had heard that his daughter had done it, and he is officially canceling her vows and freeing her. And I personally believe, on the basis of this chapter, he had the right to do that. I don't think that a young girl does have the right to marry a man against her father's wishes if he chooses to nullify it. Now, we might say, but that's Old Testament. Yeah, but families are still families. You know, fathers are still fathers. Husbands are still husbands. I mean, God, though the covenants have changed, God hasn't reorganized the family. The family is organized in Genesis chapter 2. And Jesus counted on what Genesis chapter 2 said as the basis for understanding proper family and marriage relationships. So it seems to me that there's no difference between the old covenant and the new covenant as far as the authority of a father over his children. Certainly, if anything, Paul indicates that the authority of parents over their children is the same as under the law. When Paul in Ephesians chapter 6 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, and then he quotes the commandment from Exodus, honor your father and your mother. And so it would seem that Paul is saying family structure and parental authority is the same as it was in the Old Testament. Now, that would feel awkward, probably especially to a modern woman or a man who marries her, if her parents didn't approve of the marriage, assuming she's a virgin daughter who's still living at home and so forth. I mean, the woman's been out. It says if she's divorced or she's widowed, that's a different story. There's a different provision made. We're talking about, it specifically says, a girl, verse 3, while in her father's house in her youth. He has not yet given her away. He's never relinquished his authority over her, and yet she makes a vow. Now, this is not talking about wedding vows. It's talking usually about vowing something else to the Lord. But it specifically says, if she makes a vow or binds herself by some agreement. And that is, of course, what it says also throughout this whole section, that it's talking about people making vows or binding themselves in some way to some agreement. In my opinion, this Christian father, I know, had every right to nullify his daughter's wrongful vows. And I believe she's back in his home now and not with her criminal illegitimate husband. Now, verse 6 modifies the situation slightly. But if indeed she takes a husband while bound by her vows, now that is, she made vows in her father's house. Her father did not nullify them, so they're binding. But she hasn't kept them yet, now she gets married. Now her vows are a concern to her new husband, as they would have been to her father before. And the new husband has now stepped into the position to either confirm or nullify these vows, the position that was once held by her father. So if indeed she takes a husband while bound by her vows or by a rash utterance from her lips by which she bound herself, and her husband hears it and makes no response to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand, and her agreements by which she bound herself will stand. But if her husband overrules her on the day he hears it, he shall make void her vow, which she vowed, and what she uttered with her lips, by which she bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. But any vow of a widow or a divorced woman by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. That is, she'll have to keep it, just like a man would. The very same thing that said of a man in verse 2 is true of a woman who does not have a man to whom she answers. Verse 10, if she vowed in her husband's house, that is, this is the third situation. The first situation, she's in her father's house. The second situation, she made a vow in her father's house. It wasn't nullified by her father, but now she's in a new home, her husband, and now her husband has the right to nullify. But now, it's talking about a woman who is already married and makes a vow, and this is the third circumstance, or the fourth if you include the widowed and divorced woman. So she makes a vow in her husband's house, or she's bound herself by an agreement with an oath, and her husband heard it and made no response to her and did not overrule her. Then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband truly made them void on the day he heard them, then whatever proceeded from her lips concerning her vows or concerning the agreement binding her, it shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and the Lord will forgive her or release her from her vows. Every vow and every binding oath to afflict her soul, her husband may confirm it, or her husband may make it void. Now, to afflict her soul, as I say, that term usually refers to fasting. And I'm not sure exactly why a vow to afflict her soul is mentioned, unless it was typical to fast on the same occasion that you came to the temple to pay your vows, and so it's just referring to that. Or maybe it's even saying any vow, even the smallest thing, like even if she vows that she's going to fast a certain day, her husband can overrule that. In any case, it says in verse 14, but if her husband makes no response whatsoever to her from the day, from day to day, then he confirms all her vows. Now, he confirms them non-verbally. There's a principle of law, not the law of Moses per se, but basically modern legal systems. The Latin term for it is qui tacit consentire videtur, which is probably not the correct pronunciation of the Latin. But it means silence is counted as consent. We see that also found in another law that comes up in Deuteronomy, and that is if a man sleeps with a woman who is betrothed to somebody else, they should both be put to death because she's betrothed. She's like a married woman. It's adultery. But it says she will be put to death with him if it happened in the city, but not if it happened out in the country. If it happened out in the countryside, the assumption is it was done in a place where even if she cried out for help, no one could help her. So she might well have cried out for help, and the presumption of innocence is given to her. She, if it turns out that she's caught and that a man has slept with her and it was out in some private place where no one could hear if she shouted, the assumption is she shouted. Now, she might not have. She might have been consenting, but it has given her the benefit of the doubt that since no one could have heard if she shouted, she's presumed innocent, and therefore she's not punished. But if it took place in town, where there were people around, obviously, in the next room or even in the same room, because many people lived in villages in one-room houses, it's assumed that she could have cried out. And if she didn't cry out, if this happened in town and she didn't cry out, then she is considered to be consenting to it. So her silence is counted as consent in that case, too. This is a principle that is recognized in modern law. It's also recognized in the law of Moses, apparently. And in fact, it's stated in very clear terms in verse 14. If her husband makes no response whatever to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows. He confirms it silently by not saying anything. Okay? So, verse 15 says, but if he does make them void after he has heard them, and I believe this means more than one day after he heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. Now, I'm not sure when it says after he has heard. I don't know if that means legitimately, you know, he has the right to cancel his daughter's or his wife's vow the day he hears it. But if he does, he bears her guilt. She is forgiven. She's released. But he's the one responsible for making her break her vow. In which case, he's done something incurring guilt. But I think it's more likely that since God has been saying all the way through here that the husband or the father is in the position to nullify the vow, and that's his authority to do that, that it's saying that if he waits more than a day after he hears it and then cancels her vow, then there's guilt involved in that. It says, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between a man and his wife and between a father and his daughter in her youth in her father's house. And this is really a situation where we don't have very many parallels today, because making vows is not something that happens very often in our society. In those days, they confirmed almost every transaction with a vow, with an oath of some kind. They didn't have signed contracts like we do very often. They would make verbal contracts, and they would vow or oath, make an agreement, bind themselves. And then, of course, it was absolutely essential that they honor that verbal agreement that they had bound themselves to, just like it's important to honor a written contract. But we have written contracts instead. And I suppose this would apply to written contracts in our society. That a wife who makes a contract, or a daughter who's in her father's home makes a contract, if her father, or in the other case, husband, doesn't approve of that, then he can cancel it. However, our courts of law would not necessarily assume that. If the daughter was especially over 18, she would be considered to be bound by law, no matter what her father wanted, or a woman, no matter what her husband wanted. In the law of Moses, however, the father and the husband were counted as the protectors of those in their household. And if the father believed that his daughter or wife had made a foolish and hurtful vow, he could get her out of it. He was there to protect her from making such foolish vows. Now, we don't know that he would always cancel it because he thought it was foolish. He might not be as generous as his wife, and she may offer to offer something to God that he wouldn't want to offer to God. But he still has the right to cancel that. Someone has to be in charge of the household, and God put the father in charge of the household. And so I believe, although it doesn't say so, that a young son still living in the household who has not reached the age of maturity, if he made a vow, obviously it would be something the father could cancel too, for the same reason. Because the son, who's not of age, and the daughter still living at home, are both under the authority of their father. What this does confirm, although it may not be easy to find modern situations where it would be applied, because we don't make vows like this very often, what this does confirm, though, is that God did give the father and the husband authority in the household, even an authority that allowed him to cancel what God would ordinarily require of the woman with her vow. And we see also in another case in Scripture that, and we've encountered this in Exodus, that if a man sleeps with a woman who's not betrothed, and therefore she is available to marry, then he's required to marry her. But if her father refuses, well, then the man can't marry her. The father, in a case like that where God would require a couple to get married because they've had sex together, God even allows the father to veto that. Say, no, that's not going to happen. And that is honored then by God. All right, well, that's the end of that chapter, and really the end of the section that we want to take today.